Welcome to the Intelligence Hour, cutting edge expose on the actions of government in light of the U.S. Constitution. I'm your host, former CIA officer Kevin Shipp, reporting to you from a secure studio somewhere deep in the southern United States. As always, I introduce the program with these questions. Do we live under a post-constitutional government? Is there really a shadow government or deep state that controls Washington, D.C.? All you have to do lately is just watch the news, and it seems everybody's talking about that. Why does it seem like congressional hearings on government corruption never go anywhere? We watch them, we see these compelling discussions by congressmen and senators, and then nothing happens. Why do government officials and heads of major Wall Street corporations commit crimes and even lie under oath, but they're never charged? We're seeing a lot of that going on right now as the drama plays out. And why does the mainstream media not report on some of these issues? They just clean leave things out. Syria is a hotbed right now, and some of the stories in Syria just aren't being reported on. And we'll talk about that in a later program. These are the issues that we deal with on this program. Every week, head on, we have no conservative or liberal bias, no Republican or Democratic influence or affiliation, and no manipulation by large corporate sponsors. So we're free just to focus on the truth and bring that out as best we can in any way we can. The Intelligence Hour has one goal, to fulfill our constitutional responsibility, as the media and the press should, to inform you, the American people, our audience, about the actions of your government. Not much of that information is getting out these days, it seems. You're the voice of government by the people, our audience, and every one of you out there. You're the solution to restoring freedom and peace and justice in this country. And as we've seen down through history, one man, one woman can make a difference. Because I believe in your courage and resolve to make a difference, I humbly take the risk, and I've been doing this for a while, every week, to expose the unconstitutional actions of government. I do it because I adore this country. I served it, I swore an oath to the Constitution, and I do it for the love of freedom. So, sit back tonight on this Monday evening, relax, kick back for a fascinating discussion on the current state of our government, considering the greatest governing document ever written by mankind, and that is the U.S. Constitution.
Red hot protest line, freedom scribbled on your sign. Headline, New York Times, standing on the edge of a revolution. Just obey the secret safe with the NSA. God we trust or the CIA. Standing on the edge of a revolution.
Tonight, we have again as our guest, Martin Kaiser. Martin is the author of two books, Odyssey of an Eavesdropper and Help Yourself, A Story of FBI Corruption. Mr. Kaiser's been called the Michelangelo of eavesdropping devices, and he developed devices, eavesdropping and countermeasures devices, for some of the major three-letter agencies in the federal government, perhaps the CIA being one, the FBI, and several other government agencies. Mr. Kaiser was the technical advisor for the movie Enemy of the State, which was a chillingly prophetic movie about NSA surveillance, which largely came true several years later. If you've not seen that movie, you ought to see it. It is phenomenal. If you look at the current NSA domestic surveillance program, that movie just called it out before anyone even knew. Remarkable. I've known Marty for probably over 15 years, I suppose. Marty and I hooked up when I came out of the CIA in 2002. And Marty came and taught a countermeasures course in one of my classes for private investigators, and we've been corresponding ever since. I know and respect Marty well, and of course I've known him for quite a bit, quite a lot of time. So much so, I read both of Marty's books in detail, and especially Help Yourself, A Story of FBI Corruption. I decided to go ahead and write a foreword for that book because it was so compelling. And what I want to do, as I've done in a previous program, is I want to read the foreword to that book because I think it describes Marty and his background and kind of how that dovetails into the current things we're seeing in Washington, D.C. This is the foreword. Marty Kaiser grew up in a blue-collar working family in northeastern Pennsylvania. He was the typical patriotic American with a love for his country and a dream to someday make a difference. He was to go on and become the U.S. government's top technical eavesdropping spymaster, a man who could craft a bug or listening device no one could find, or build a system that would detect devices planted by foreign governments. Marty's U.S. government clients for surveillance and counter-surveillance equipment included the who's who of the three-letter covert intelligence agencies. He was the equivalent of Agent Q in the British James Bond movies. Marty Kaiser is also a man of ethics and integrity. When called to testify before the House Select Committee on Intelligence regarding the FBI's wiretapping procedures, he simply told the truth in an effort to assist the committee with his investigation. That testimony would place him on a collision course with internal FBI corruption at the highest levels and make him a target of shocking retribution. Because of his mastery of technical eavesdropping, Marty was recruited by Walt Disney Productions' Touchstone Pictures to provide technical support for the surveillance devices portrayed in the movie I mentioned, Enemy of the State. The film is an excellent portrayal of the power of government secrecy and surveillance and the consequences of its abuse. How ironic it is that the theme of the film would be played out in real life with the advent of the NSA domestic spy program, which secretly arose out of the unbridled USA Patriot Act. NSA surveillance of innocent U.S. citizens would indeed become a reality. The FBI would begin secret warrantless searches of Americans' homes at least 4,000 times. Then they claimed they couldn't remember how many times under oath. And businesses and the CIA would operate and the CIA would operate secret prisons around the world under horrific conditions. And let me add, it was not just waterboarding. All of this would be done without constitutional validation. Help Yourself, book by Marty, is a fascinating, uncensored, and refreshingly candid story of a man who rose to be considered the U.S. government's top expert on eavesdropping. It's the story of a man who went up against the Goliath of government corruption alone and paid the price for refusing to back down from the truth. Help Yourself is the story of how the government can become alarmingly corrupted by the abuse of secrecy and the addiction to power of its agents. These agents attempted to destroy the business, reputation, and family of a true American patriot who simply wanted to serve his country. But in Marty Kaiser's case, they messed with the wrong man. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce Martin Kaiser. Marty, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kevin. It's an honor to be here.
It's great to have you here again. Marty, your story is fascinating in both your books. And I just want to begin just to open it up and let you tell your incredible story. How did this all begin, Marty?
I'm sorry I missed that question.
Yeah, hey, no worries. We've got a bit of a connection here. You've got a fascinating story to tell regarding your past and especially coming out of the foreword I wrote to your book. How did this all begin with your background working for the three-letter agencies and eventually coming across the FBI? Go through your story and tell us how that all began.
Well, it's best to quickly go over my job experience to get me in line with the current events. I started at RCA Laboratories in Princeton, New Jersey as a technician, and within 6 years, I had assembled and installed a over-horizon radar system in Barbados, West Indies. When I came back from Barbados, I had asked for a position that was inconsistent with my background, and the RCA couldn't meet the terms, so I left RCA. I started my own company in 1965 after working briefly for Telerad and developing the command receiver for the Atlas missile. And initially, I started servicing companies like Armco Steel, which made steel, Kennecott Copper, which made copper wire, did all kinds of companies like Sweetheart Cup that made ice cream cones, both soft cones and hard cones, and eventually started servicing all the breweries in Baltimore. One brewery in particular, an American brewery, was a little contract brewery with a big ammonia compressor, and they just did contract bottles for a variety of companies. I learned very quickly that the new beer comes down the pipes early in the morning, and they turn open the valves and let it run on the floor. And I couldn't see that happening, and of course all the employees couldn't see that happening. So I had probably more than my share of beer, and when I left there, I made a wrong turn, and eventually wound up in front of a gate to U.S. Army Intelligence, Fort Holabird, Maryland. I thought, well, they have to have something broken in there, a little bit of pun there. So I went in and happened to knock on the right door, and within a matter of a year, I was manufacturing audio amplifiers for them and RF detectors, all kinds of countermeasure and eavesdropping equipment. As my name spread, I wound up building equipment for virtually all of the three-letter agencies and a lot of other agencies that are known by names rather than letters. And through those contacts, I started teaching at the various academies, the U.S. Army Intelligence Academy, the Pennsylvania State Police Academy, and other law enforcement academies. And I continued to develop a whole line of products, and these products were new to the industry. No one really understood what was useful, not necessary, but useful, and I convinced them that it was useful. But my product line expanded to almost 600 different products. And I've been using the MI, and that's basically me. I've been a one-person company for the entire duration of time. Occasionally, I have a secretary, and I train her how to do wiring and assembly, and between the two of us, we service the world in the area of countermeasure equipment. I also, at the time, made bomb disposal and bomb detection equipment for the Explosive Ordnance Group. Through a series of events, I wound up lecturing at Fort Holabird, Maryland. And I just have this unique ability to be able to talk technical material with people who have no technical background whatsoever, and that went over very well. In one of those classes, I met Larry Linville of the Metro Washington Bomb Squad, and that got me into the bomb business, and I made a whole bunch of equipment for them, like stethoscopes and probes for radio control bombs and probes for collapsing field bombs. So everything went along just fine. And in 1968, Congress passed a law called the Omnibus Crime Bill, which regulated the possession and manufacture of eavesdropping devices. Once I was made aware of that law, I thought, well, I better get in line with everybody else or there's going to be trouble on the scene. So I complied with the law and sold only to bona fide law enforcement agencies. Now, that's on the side of the eavesdropping equipment. But the countermeasure equipment I sold to industry throughout the world, and there was no problem with that because that didn't involve the law. But the law had an automatic 5-year review period, so they could tell if people were complying with the law. I was contacted in 1975 by the House Select Committee on Intelligence and asked about my records of these types of sales of regulated equipment. And rather than, I considered myself an open person. I mean, they needed information, and I was willing to give them the information. So mm-hmm. I opened my files to them and let them see all of the equipment that I had manufactured for law enforcement agencies under Public Law 18 U.S.C. 2512. In that collection of invoices were some from a U.S. recording company. And they said, well, who's this? This appears to be a commercial company, and you're violating the law by selling to them. I said, well, that's the FBI. The FBI had a little phony front set up called U.S. Recording Company, and all orders had to be routed through them, both for countermeasure equipment and surveillance equipment. So next thing I know, I'm before Congress telling the same story, and I didn't realize that that phony front was owned personally by the high-level management of the FBI, and they funneled about $25 million through that front, of which they personally pocketed $7.5 million. Hmm. Well, once that revelation was made, my business fell to zero on the surveillance side of things, and on the countermeasure side, that fell too with intelligence agencies, but other agencies continued to use it. So it took the FBI about 3 years after a whole string of harassment attempts to entrap me, and I stuck with my basic business principles and avoided all that kind of stuff. So it took the FBI about 3 years to fabricate a crime and criminally indict me for hugging the FBI. Uh-huh. And that whole story moves very rapidly. I guess I should back up a bit and talk about the people that were involved in this this whole scheme, so to
sure.
speak. But I found myself in front of a grand jury in North Wilkesboro, North Carolina. I'm sorry, in Greensboro, North Carolina. And my attorney that I hired, Bud Fenstuhl, said, you just got to take the Fifth Amendment for every question they ask you. It doesn't matter what they ask you. Just take the Fifth Amendment. So I did about 150 times. And eventually that ended. And when I left the room, my paralegal, Mark Feldman, asked me to tell him what I saw in the grand jury room. So I went around the grand jury with the prosecutor to the right, and then next to him, the stenographer, and then next to them, the grand jurors. And at the far left corner of the room sat the FBI agent. And Mark said, what? It turns out that it's illegal for a government agent to be present in a grand jury during grand jury testimony.
That's right.
So Bud Fenstuhl immediately put an appeal before the court saying that he wanted the charges to drop because of impropriety on the part of the FBI. And that led to a very interesting event. Obviously, if I was placed on the stand, I'd say the FBI was there. And if he were placed on the stand, he wasn't there. Which was the only way he could stay out of jail. But what happened, the judge turned to me and said, Mr. Kaiser, you're mistaken, honest or otherwise. And that was the end of that. But as a byproduct of that sequence of events, I wound up with the names and addresses of all the grand jurors that indicted me. So I tucked that away in my pocket, and we went on from there. Of course, once you get indicted, you have to be arraigned to determine your guilt or innocence. And when we met for that event, there were 20 other people on the roster ahead of me, and they were all sitting in a row in the front of the courtroom. All of them were in their early 30s, and all of them pled not guilty to the charges against them, but the charges weren't specified. So it was quite obvious they were all FBI agents, and the whole purpose of that exercise was to burn as much of my legal funds as possible. And it was a pretty substantial amount because we're talking $1,978, and I was paying $400 an hour for legal service. So it was a fairly expensive exercise, but my attorney knew that this was going to happen, and he was prepared for it. So I eventually was arraigned and thrown in the bowels of the D.C. jail for a day while everybody figured out what to do with me. And they decided, well, I should just be released on my own recognizance. And I was. We then went, got ready for the trial. And it was a fairly straightforward effort because we knew the charges very clearly and we knew what our response was going to be. So we dug into the trial process with, it was a serious effort. When I started my trial, they went through the usual process of trying to build the case, and the first step was to show that I had imported a device primarily designed for surreptitious interception of oral communication. But in reality, it was a hearing aid microphone, and there's nothing illegal about those things. But they tried to make a case based on that, and then it was my intent to use that for an eavesdropping device, and that didn't pan out well for them. So the next thing on the what I did when I installed this device, the object of, well, let me backtrack on that. The object of this device was to intercept the communications of the FBI agents that were investigating the bank. And so I installed the microphone in the room the FBI agents were using and ran it to the vice president's office so he could monitor any conversation by the FBI. That is it's a perfectly, or it was a perfectly legal thing to do because as long as there's one party consent in the process, it's legal.
Right.
And so after I installed the device, they attempted to record the conversation, and all they got was noise, just a lot of noise on the tape, and that becomes important later on. So I planted the device in a telephone jack with the intent of it being found. I knew that the room was probably bugged by the FBI, and I prepared myself accordingly. So we then went on from there to went on from there to the trial itself. And the first thing they tried to prove was that it was indeed an eavesdropping device, and they did that by bringing in their FBI technical expert, who explained in great detail how he found this microphone in the wall. And my attorney eventually rose and asked him, well, where did you get the equipment to do that job? And he pointed over at me, and he said, well, Marty over there. So the newspaper the next day said FBI uses Kaiser equipment to find Kaiser bug.
Yeah.
So it was an embarrassment. But after they went through their case of finding the device and trying to prove it was a surreptitious device, the next thing was to track the trace of the track the invoice that I sent the Northwestern Bank to do the job. So they brought in a string of Northwestern Bank employees to explain how they passed the invoice off from one person to another. The invoice was written on one of those envelopes that you fold the side flaps in, fold it in half, seal it, and send it off with a stamp. But one of the interesting things about those types of invoices and envelopes is you can squeeze them and cause them to open so you can see the contents inside. So when they presented the invoice, it still hadn't been opened, even though seven people had handled the thing. But one of the things I think my attorney missed the point on was have you ever heard of anybody invoicing somebody for a criminal act? And of course, nobody had. I then put on my character witnesses, who were all law enforcement people. Jim Regan of Pennsylvania State Police, Cliff Lund, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, Mike Lizak, U.S. Army EOD, and I put a CIA agent on there, too, because he was involved in a lot of my activities. So we went through the witnesses, and they all gave me a first-class rating, with the exception of the CIA agent. And when it was his turn, the doors of the courtroom crashed open, and three guys came rushing in with black suitcases and pointy-toe shoes. And the judge said, let's go to the chambers. And everybody went into the judge's room, including the FBI agent that had caused me to be indicted. And that I just couldn't see how that could happen, but it did happen. So after
so you can just see a process unfolding here of you basically being entrapped.
Oh yes, yes, I definitely was entrapped. There were the whole sequence of events that was centered around that entrapment, and some of them I just told you about. But one of the interesting things, and we never really got a chance to present it at trial because there was no place to put it in the trial. Oh, let me just backtrack briefly. When we got to the point where the tape was introduced into evidence, the FBI agent who was sitting to the right of the prosecuting attorney jumped up and said, "That's my voice on that tape, and you can't listen to it." And my attorney let that pass by because he had his plan on how the trial should unfold. But I thought it interesting that an FBI agent could testify on his behalf without anybody, without having taken an oath or subjected himself to any cross-examination whatsoever. He said, "You can't listen to it," and that's that.
Yeah, and admitting that he was there at the same time. Yeah, go ahead.
So one of the things that happened, we managed to obtain the tape through the evidentiary process, and I had a tape expert, Rodden Smith, analyze the tape, and it was 2.5 hours of noise, just a hissing noise. And then right in the middle of the whole tape, this voice of the FBI agent pops up. Well, on tape analysis, it was clear that he had overtaped what was already on the tape. So it was a reverse Nixon thing. Rather than taking 50 seconds, 15 minutes out of the tape, he put 15 minutes on the tape. And that issue never came to trial. And I thought that was unfortunate because by that time I had spent a substantial amount of money trying to prove my innocence, and we were just spinning around in wheels in some areas.
Mm-hmm.
But we got through the trial. I was found not guilty. One of the interesting things, when the case was turned over to the jury was out for about 15 minutes, and they asked to see the judge, which was granted, and they came back in the courtroom, and they asked the judge for a transcript of the trial. And the judge sort of smiled, and he said, "No, you just got to work with what you heard, and that's that." But I think everybody in the jury must have been confused trying to figure out where the crime was. And the end result was that I was found not guilty on all three charges. But it's a shame.
They drugged you through all of this and the legal expense and everything else when you were innocent, you weren't guilty in the first place, and it appears part of the MO of their entrapment was just to destroy you financially and wear you out over time.
Yes, and they did a fairly good job. I was prepared for them, and I spent $75,000 defending myself. Now we're talking 1978 dollars, so it was a substantial amount of money for a little guy who had a part-time employee.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
So after the trial was over, about 3 months went by, and the two FBI agents that caused me to be indicted sued me for $22 million, claiming I caused them mental anguish.
Oh, gosh.
The one FBI agent said I aggravated the sty in his eye, and the other FBI, said I aggravated his hemorrhoidal condition.
Now, I have to tell you there, I that's a position of honor, because I think you're the first person that I have ever heard of that has actually given a federal agent hemorrhoids. You should have some kind of trophy for that. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Articles appeared in papers worldwide, kinds of pain in the ass as FBI. And I appeared on the front page of the London Daily Telegraph and the front page of papers all over the world, but there wasn't a single thing in the U.S., not a single word.
Interesting.
And that clearly shows the power of the FBI to intimidate newspapers and news media into not exposing their wrongdoings.
Excellent point.
Yeah, that really is something. I responded with a civil suit, or counter suit, addressing all the problems of the trial and the difficulties they had caused me. And that went on, that case went on until 1983. So we're talking 1978 to 1983.
Goodness.
And the trouble with civil suits is you can lie like a son of a gun in them, and then when somebody catches you, reverse your testimony, you go off on another course. So all of that burns up in a lot of expensive legal time. And in my case, it ultimately cost me $300,000.
Goodness.
And that really hurt.
Oh, yeah.
But I brought the case against the FBI agents, and I eventually added the FBI itself to the case, and a lot of interrogatories ran back and forth between all those agencies and my attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, my insurance company settled with these two guys, as well as Northwestern Bank, who was the original organization that hired me to do this eavesdropping. And
These two alleged boogerheads, if you will, actually made money off that little plot that they did, the two FBI guys?
Yes.
Goodness.
I'm not supposed to say the actual amount, but they wound up wealthy men.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and that's really sad for aggravated hemorrhoids. I would hope that if I ever brought a civil suit against somebody, I'd come up with a more reasonable complaint.
That'll keep that FBI agent in Preparation H, probably for 50, 60 years, you know? Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, and it's really sad that that kind of stuff occurs.
Yeah,
but,
it is.
During this whole process of addressing the civil suit, I alleged improprieties on the part of the FBI and demanded that I'd be able to see all of my FBI files. And they were eventually given to me. It was a stack about 6-7 inches tall. And when you looked at this stack of documents, I have to go back again on this thing. But after my trial, I wrote to all the grand jurors, and I said, here's what you did to me. I was very straightforward, not threatening or anything. I said, here's what you did to me, blah, blah, blah. So when I got my FBI files, all 24 of the letters I sent to those grand jurors were on top of the FBI file, which means that he had sent agents out to intimidate the recipients into giving them the letter, and they put in their file. That was probably the most disappointing part of the whole sequence of events, is that none of these grand jurors had the guts to say to the FBI, hey, look, that guy sent a letter to me. I'll give you a copy, but it's my letter. But they didn't. They all surrendered the original letter to the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
Also, when you looked at the file, there were green pages all the way down. It represented about 20% of the file. And what they were sign-out sheets for documents signed by none other than the agent with the sty in the eye.
Hmm.
So I went through all those files. Or I read all of the grand jury of all of the trials involving Northwestern Bank, the chairman of the bank, the executive vice president, the director of security. All of those things were in the file, and it was interesting reading. In one case, they had me in five places at exactly the same time. And I had been sent to Egypt to train President Sadat's people, and that information was in there. And I said, look, I will tell you, I will show you my passport, I'll show you the purchase order I had, I'll show you all the details around surrounding that event. Get the rest of those things out of there. And they said, no, we can't remove those from the file. And that's one of the problems with FBI files. They wind up full of erroneous information that's used to cause people problems in general. I was hoping for a higher standard than that, but that's just the way it is, and I had to live with that.
Yep, yes it is, yeah, sad. Sad, yeah, that's the government usually stacked up against your average common person, but yeah, they're not surprising. Okay, so where did it go from there?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Yeah, so from there, you went through your file and you found all of this information, grand jury information. Grand jury testimonies and interactions are supposed to be restricted and secret from just about anyone. But and you found information directly from these two agents, one that had the hemorrhoids and the other had the sty. Obviously, they'd been manipulating the file, too, and there was erroneous information in there, probably intentionally. That remains a part of the record. And I'm bringing these things up because I've seen this over and over and over with the CIA, the FBI, and other agencies that have this power of secrecy and control and kind of use the system for their own benefit. But that sounds like what they did here with you, especially the part that is clearly entrapment.
Yeah, one of the interesting things, it's sort of a sad event, but I was in trial in the criminal case for 3 months. I'm sorry, 3 days. Wait a second, 3 months. Sorry about that. But every weekend, I would go fly back to my shop in Cockeysville, Maryland, and manufacture wood equipment that I had to manufacture, send it out, and then go back to the trial. So I was actually working on weekends during the trial because I felt I was obliged to support my customers, and I did that as best I could, even under the circumstances of the trial. But it played very heavily on my family. They had trouble understanding what was going on. They too were confused by my indictment and trial and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure a psychological burden to them. And I.
No doubt.
My wife doesn't talk about it much, but she recently revealed how she was unable to understand what was happening and didn't know how to support me. So I was pretty much on my own.
Trying to work
through this. So I continued to, after the trial, I continued to manufacture equipment, even though I was under the threat of that civil suit. And I supplied most of the bomb disposal equipment used throughout the world. And I also taught at the Naval Ordnance EOD facility. When you entered the Navy facility, there was a fairly large display. I'd say it was probably 30 feet across and 20 feet high. And as I drove in, it would say, "Welcome, Marty Kaiser, Marty L. Kaiser, Inc." And the FBI fought tooth and nail to have that sign, have those displays removed. And they also tried to interfere with my classes. And I every class I gave at Naval Ordnance had two FBI agents standing in the back of the room, sort of trying to intimidate me, but it didn't do them any good. So that was the sequence of events that was after the actual trial and during the midst of the civil case. I wish it could have gone a different way, but it just didn't, And unfortunately, to this day, I am still harassed by the FBI in a variety of forms, from misrouting of mail and things along that line.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, Marty, it's phenomenal because, and I deal with a lot of whistleblowers, and we're going to have some more NSA guys and others on here. This is a pattern of procedure that has happened in almost every case of someone that has crossed specifically one of the three-letter agencies. They have a specific procedure. In July 28th coming up, I'm giving a speech on how the government silences whistleblowers. I've seen an exact pattern. Yours fits the pattern so perfectly. You'll cross them, come across some sort of corrupt illegal activity. They'll target you for trumped-up charges. They'll force you to get an attorney, and many times they'll force you to use their attorney in the case of the CIA. They'll drain your finances, drag it out over time, put you hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, put an extreme amount of pressure on your family. And a lot of families don't make it. They break up, which is part of the plan. Right. And they draw this legal process out for years. And in the process of that, they will put false documents in your file, as they did with yours, portraying you as a security risk or something like that. Then they'll start tapping your phones, doing other things. That happened to me when I first started confronting my agency about the cover-up break-ins and things like that. It was kind of funny. My cell phone would turn itself on and off. My cell phone would record my conversations in the room and then mistakenly save it to my voicemail. And on and on and on and on it went. That continues today. It's important to understand when you talk about your continued harassment how unbelievably unconstitutional and tyrannical this activity is. But up until now, and that's the function of this program and others, they've gotten away with this with impunity.
Yeah, true. One event that comes to mind, which is probably the most despicable conduct of the FBI, was my son was arrested with 3 ounces of marijuana, and they charged him with possession with intent to distribute and some other charge. I forget what the third one was.
Mm-hmm.
So I hired an attorney. He actually was above my shop in Cockeysville. Hired an attorney to work out a plea of possession, which for 3 ounces of marijuana, that fits right there. When we went to trial, and it came to play, admitting to a plea, the attorney suggested that he plead to the charge of possession with intent to distribute. And my son did, so he walked out of that courtroom a convicted drug dealer over 3 ounces of marijuana. But what was really disturbing, I later learned that the attorney that I hired was a former FBI agent. So you had the former FBI, and there were two FBI agents in the back of the courtroom for this little basic trial. So
what
the FBI surrounded the whole sequence of events. And, of course, that weighed heavily on my son and weighed heavily on me and my wife.
Oh, yeah. You hit on an incredibly valuable point. I think a lot of people don't realize because it hasn't gotten out there until now. Part of what they will do is not just try to destroy you. They will also have the gall and the hubris to destroy your family, in this case, your son. And they're getting to you through your son. That happened with my family and my son. He was poisoned in this particular location and almost died, as did my wife, with what they're being exposed to. But they literally were following him, surveilling him, which is illegal in the United States to follow a U.S. citizen. They were following him. They ran him off the road one night. He's still, I understand he's writing his own book. This is Joey, my son, is writing his own book now about his experiences as the son of an officer and what he went through. They literally went after him, an innocent young man. He was 18 years old. Were following him, breaking into his car, opening his mail, and he just got his mail opened recently. He's writing a book now. So they won't just stop at you. They'll go for your family. And what's the best way to get to a man or a woman? The best way to destroy them? It's always your family. That's where they always go. But the shocking part here is we're talking about the United States government, a government that's supposed to be functioning under the Constitution and serving the people, not only targeting innocent people with this power of secrecy and corruption they have, but if that doesn't work, they literally go after their family and even their sons, their daughters, and their wife.
Yes, That's I know that all too well.
One of the things, Marty, I'm thinking about. It's funny how these things, a lot of these things, just hit me in the middle of the night at 2 or 3 when I can't sleep. Probably happens to you. I guess it's a double A mind or whatever. But anyway, I'm going to start reaching out to some of the wives of these whistleblowers, kind of the silent heroes, heroines out there, who've had to endure this, what their husbands went through, which directly affected them and their finances and their children. I'm going to put a request out there for the wives of some whistleblowers and see if they want to come on and tell their side of the story, because up until now, they've kind of been the unheard voices that had to suffer through all this. And I think it's maybe time their voice is heard also. But you're just another classic case, Marty. And when I give this speech in July, and I'm not saying exactly where yet for obvious reasons, I'm going to expose in detail an exact system that these agencies use to target and silence whistleblowers. And it is a system, some of which we've just talked about. You've lived it. I've lived it. Other whistleblowers have lived it. It is a system that they use. It's the same every single time. 9 times out of 10, it'll stop and destroy the person until they come across somebody like you and they mess with the wrong man whose character is more important than fear, and that person doesn't back down and they have to amplify. So this is a specific system, and this is just, I call it the shadow government. What I mean by that is the secret side of government, the secret intelligence agencies, the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, that have this power of secrecy, access to files, the ability to trump up charges and do things that are shocking and unbelievable, well, in what I call now a post-constitutional government. So I'll be giving that speech in July. A lot of people, whistleblowers, will find that it just patterns their case exactly because it's a procedure that they use. Marty, how did this all wind up? I guess you won your case. They had put you deep in debt, which is part of their MO. How did this all wind up? Do you still have legal bills? You say they're still harassing you. Are you still paying off your legal bills? Did you finally kind of get past it, or you still have to live with it?
Well, they on the legal side of things, they finally killed the golden goose, so to speak. And I had to walk away from the last invoice, which was $28,000. I wasn't about to mortgage my house to pay that bill, so... The attorney and I came to a party. Now that was the attorney that did primarily the civil, the criminal case, and he did a bit of the civil. But after I let him go, a friend of mine, another attorney out of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, picked up and didn't charge me anything to wrap the thing up.
Great. That's great. There's some good attorneys out there. They're hard to find in intelligence cases, but there's some good ones out there.
Yeah.
You know, in our case, I happened to find, and I'm not mentioning his name without his permission, I happened to find a good kind of strapping Texas attorney who wasn't afraid of anybody that took our case. And of course, when he found out who he was dealing with, he was pretty surprised. But he had incredible courage, and so much so that he actually forced my agency, and the judge did too, to go to a mediated settlement by a federal judge. That's how strong the case was of the poisoning and the illness and the break-ins and the surveillance and all of that, and the documents, evidence that I provided, which was pretty quite a bit. So the agency went to mediation, obviously reluctantly, after multiple threats to me and even to my family. They went to a mediated settlement, and everybody was like, man, this has never happened before. This is remarkable. They're actually going to settle. Well, they did settle. We walked out of there thinking it was over, but again, part of the MO to just wear the person out and destroy them. We get a phone call, my attorneys do, 3 days later saying, we're not going to abide by the settlement. He's like, what do you mean you're not going to abide by the settlement? We signed it and you agreed to it. Well, we're not going to do it. If Mr. Ship doesn't take one quarter of the settlement amount, and of course I can't say what that amount was, it certainly wasn't enough, but if he doesn't take one quarter of that amount, then we're going to invoke the state's secrets privilege and seal his case forever, and then they'll be threatened with prison if they say anything about it to anyone. And my attorneys were absolutely shocked. He called me, he said, look, I've never seen this before in my entire life. This is unbelievably illegal. What do you want us to do? And I said, well, you go back and you tell them they agreed to a settlement, and we're not going to go for less. You tell them to abide by the agreement that they made. Well, what did they do? They invoked the privilege, sealed the case, then threatened us with prison if me or my family, wife and children, talked about the case. And you're talking doctor's diagnosis, environmental test reports, nothing unclassified, nothing about the government, nothing about my position, absolutely nothing. If we talked to anybody about that information, then we were threatened with prison for violating their seal. That's how far they went. Now, like in your case, I finally, you know, you go through the soul searching. What do you do about this? And a lot of people, you know, bless their hearts. They don't want their family to be destroyed. They just be quiet and they fade away into the shadows, so to speak. And there's thousands of people out there that have given up and just broken and gone off into the shadow. But every now and then, they go across the wrong man, like yourself, like John Kiriakou, myself and others, real patriots, real Americans that cannot let them trample on the Constitution like this and are not going to let them get away with it and proceed forward, which you did. And, you know, Marty, you're an American hero. It was your guts, your courage, and I think, above all, your character. And I think, you know, for a lot of us, our faith is involved in terms of strength. Your character that enabled you to prevail through this, write two books, and in intelligence circles, we call this blowback. When an intelligence agency tries to engage in an illegal operation, thinking that with the hubris, thinking they'll get away with it, and then the whole thing blows up in their face and gets worse than if they hadn't done anything. So now we have whistleblowers, patriots like yourself out there that have written two books and others, many of which I'll be interviewing here, and it's worse for them than if they would have just settled or left the person alone. Now what they did is public, and it's all over the place. They just don't have the sense to realize not to mess with good patriotic Americans. They're too arrogant. They think that they can pull this system off that they think they've perfected, and that they'll, because it's worked for thousands of people. But every now and then, they come across somebody like you, and the whole thing backfires, blowbacks. You got two books out there. You're on this program. You've been on others. You'll be on more. Your story is all over the world now. It would have been better if they just abided by the Constitution and took care of an honest man. But as you know, that's just not how they work.
That's right. That's right. And that's I still have a little shop here at, in Pennsylvania, and I still make the stuff I made before. No eavesdropping stuff, just countermeasure and bomb disposal equipment. And yeah, every time I pick up the soldering iron, I think, what are going to be the repercussions of doing this? Are they going to dislike mm-hmm. what I'm doing again, or what, yeah, you know, just what's going to happen? And weighs on me very heavily.
They are masters at the manipulation of fear, and they will put this. I mean, this really splintered my wife and kids apart. They'll place this fear of going to prison, fear of more agents showing up on your doorstep, and they want that fear to stick on you the rest of your life. That's the only tool of power they have, is to get people to fear them so that they become paralyzed. When we don't fear them, they got a problem, because that's their biggest weapon of intimidation, without a doubt. Well, Marty, is there, if you're still making devices, do you have a name of your business, or is there a way I can help you kind of put that before the audience?
Well, I'm still making things. I got a purchase order the other day from Oman, of all places. I mean, here's a country half a world away, still buying my stuff, all legal, of course. So I'm still turning stuff out rather than do the old routine in the business and issue invoices and demand purchase orders, et cetera, I sell everything I make now on eBay, and it goes within a matter of minutes. Mm-hmm. So everybody remembers me, and they know I make good stuff, and they try and cough it up.
Mm-hmm. Now this is explosive detection equipment, or what kind of equipment are you now marketing and selling?
For countermeasure equipment, I make audio amplifiers and radio frequency bug detectors.
Great.
Electronic.
Well, how can people, I'm sorry, Marty, how can people get in touch with you if they're interested in purchasing some of those things from you? What's the best way that they can reach you?
Well, you can go to MartyKaiser.com. That's Marty with a Y and Kaiser with an A, MartyKaiser.com, or you can go to MartyKaiser@prodigy.net. That's my email address, and it's the best way to communicate with me. But they can also communicate through the website itself. So,
yes, and they can go through me too, and I can direct them to you also. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you're out there and you want, and I know Marty, I know what he does, I've seen what he does, I think we've heard that this evening. If you are in the market for eavesdropping, bug countermeasures devices, and things like that, contact Martin Kaiser. Not only is he honest, he's a patriot, and I can tell you from personal experience, he's a man of integrity. So you can contact Marty at the sites he just gave you, or reach me at intelligencehour@gmail.com. And I want to see business start coming into Marty because he's a true patriot. Marty, we're running out of time. I want to thank you so much for coming on the program. It's been a fascinating discussion.
Okay, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you,
Marty. Here.
Okay, all right. We'll talk to you soon. Ladies and gentlemen, let me mention Martin Kaiser's books, Odyssey of an Eavesdropper and Help Yourself, A Story of FBI Corruption, can be found on Amazon.com. For Martin Kaiser's full, fascinating story, as Marty mentioned, you can go to his website, martinkaiser.com, and Kaiser is spelled K-A-I-S-E-R. And as we wrap it up, remember, you can catch my posts on my Facebook page, From the Company of Shadows, where I constantly monitor government activities in light of the Constitution. You can go to my Twitter account, @Kevin_Ship, S-H-I-P-P, or you can check out my book, From the Company of Shadows, which talks quite a bit about what Marty and I were discussing. That's on Amazon.com, From the Company of Shadows, Amazon.com. And, of course, email me with any questions or suggestions that you have. I read them all. You can reach me at intelligencehour@gmail.com. That's intelligencehour@gmail.com, and I will answer your note. I answer everyone. My thanks to Marty Kaiser for coming on, and to Jesse, our producer, for helping me make this broadcast possible. And as we close out this edition of the Intelligence Hour, I always like to leave my audience with the famous quote attributed to Thomas Jefferson. When people fear their government, there is tyranny. When the government fears the people, there is liberty. And remember, it's the Constitution that keeps us free, and it's faith, family, and friends that make life fulfilling, and that is real wealth. This is your host for the Intelligence Hour, signing off, Kevin Ship. I'll see you next week.